Rosemary Stasek, recorded October 2006.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. I am on my five-week, five-state tour, as I'm calling it, and it was a great opportunity for me to come home. I haven't been back in the Bay Area since January, so it was a great opportunity to come back and reconnect with folks, remember what it's like to live with electricity and fairly unlimited hot water, and all the sushi you can eat. So it's really, really wonderful to be home. The Bay Area is very, very much home for me. What I wanted to share with you tonight is a little bit about what is happening in Afghanistan now, what it's like to live there, and what it's like to work on projects with women there, and some of the things that we're all working on, that we've been working on for the past 4.5 years, to try to move Afghanistan a little forward. So you're going to hear some good stuff, you're going to hear some bad stuff, and hopefully I will leave you with a better sense of where we're at in Afghanistan right now. I'll talk about the current situation because that is definitely the bad news. And so we will start with that so you don't leave all depressed. And as I was asked by the folks who organized the library series, one of the things that they were doing as part of this library series was showing the documentary The Beauty Academy of Kabul. And I will actually be leading a couple film discussions on that, including one at the College of San Mateo on Monday. But they asked me to include a little bit about what's happening now. For those of you who've already seen the film or may yet see the film, I actually worked at the beauty school for last year, as their logistics manager. So I can bring you up to date on what's happening, show you a couple pictures. Then I'll show you a couple pictures about what it's like to live in Kabul, just sort of the personal side of this crazy existence. And then, to everyone's delight, I will shut up and show you some of the faces, 4.5 years worth of people that I have had the pleasure of meeting and working with, and to hopefully leave you with just a bit of a sense of the spirit of the people and what it is for those of us that are there and can't manage to pull ourselves away, regardless of the lack of electricity, hot water, and sushi. There is something really powerful that keeps us there, and I hope by looking at these faces you'll see that. When I started giving these talks, I first went to Afghanistan in early 2002, after the fall of the Taliban. As you heard, I was in office. I was on the Mountain View City Council. And after September 11th, began working with especially young women in the Afghan-American community in the Bay Area. You know, we have the largest expat Afghan community here in the Bay Area anywhere. And before September 11th, they did a pretty successful job at being invisible. It was their objective to be invisible. They had escaped from horrible war conditions, and they pretty much wanted to just live their lives as low-key as possible. That all changed, obviously, on September 11th. And working with especially young women in the community wanted to make sure that their community was seen in really a positive way, in the way it should be seen, in overcoming a lot of the ridiculous stereotypes that we heard about immediately after September 11th. So we started doing programs. We did a lot of programs trying to really raise awareness in the community about Afghan-American issues. Also, if you remember back then, we were talking a lot about the place of Islam in American society. We were all trying to understand all these issues. And so spent a lot of time doing that over the winter. After the Taliban fell, early 2002, a group of Afghan Americans were going back in one of the first delegations to go back to start looking at what were the issues around reconstruction and what needed to start happening around reconstruction. And they invited me to come along. You know, as sort of the classic politician, fact-finding, happy, happy, let me go with you tour. And, you know, just what wasn't actually supposed to happen on that trip was I wasn't supposed to fall absolutely in love with the place. and spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan and didn't want to get back on the plane. It was an incredibly, it was incredibly powerful in the sense that Afghanistan is a place of incredible emotion. You either love it or you hate it. There's not much middle ground when it comes to Afghanistan. And I absolutely loved it. It was a place of rubble, a non-functioning country. And yet there was something about it that was really, really compelling and made me want to be particularly involved in the reconstruction. So I came back and I started giving these talks. And the first slide in my talks in 2002 was always this map. Because if you recall, before September 11th, I will just admit for myself, and I think goes for many of us, couldn't pick out Afghanistan on a map if we needed to. And we started out talking about where it was in relation to the countries around it. And today I think we're all pretty fairly familiar with where Afghanistan is, but it always helps to remember who the other players in this game are, because Afghanistan has been the scene of the great game for centuries, and that has not changed. Afghanistan still continues to be the spot where other people come to fight their little issues, especially now with Pakistan on one side and Iran on the other. Both of those countries have huge vested interests in what happens in Afghanistan, and for better and worse, they are very, very active players. I was giving a talk at the Saratoga Rotary the other day, and while they were eating their chicken, I came up with this idea that I wanted to try and show, display the current situation in terms of where the Taliban is and where they are moving. And I came up with this brilliant idea that I'd throw up a map of the provinces, and I'd put really dark red where the Taliban had completely taken over, sort of red where they were doing well, and sort of pale pink where they were moving into. And of course you can tell that just, you know, I didn't have enough time and Adobe Photoshop skill while they were eating their lunch. But let me just, you know, let me just show you a little bit about what I was trying to accomplish. And what I was trying to accomplish here is to show you, these are the Northwest Frontier provinces in Pakistan. And over the past 2 years, past several years, while our military and political attention has been focused in Iraq.
Excuse me for a minute.
Yes.
North, that looks northeast to me. So why
here, this is Pakistan. In here the Northwest Frontier provinces of Pakistan.
Sorry
about that. Yep. This is southeast Afghanistan, which borders northeast Pakistan. And in here where these dots are basically the area that's known as the Northwest Frontier provinces of Pakistan. They're basically pretty much autonomous. The central government of Pakistan has almost no control in these areas. The army has actually just pulled out of them. They signed a treaty and said, basically, do whatever you want, just don't bother us. And so what's happening is while our political and military attention for the past several years has been focused on Iraq, the Taliban has had that time and that sanctuary in northwest Pakistan to regroup, recruit, and rearm. And they've enjoyed the continuing financial support of Saudi Arabia and other fundamentalist factions in that area, as well as increasing support from the money that the drug trade is generating in Afghanistan. What's happening is that the Taliban always had its support in Kandahar. The Taliban is their Pashtun ethnicity. They are Pashtuns. This is their home base in Kandahar. And they've never been completely out of Kandahar. And so they're now pretty much completely in control of Kandahar. The Canadians have the city of Kandahar, and they are really, really taking huge casualties in this fighting. The province of Helmand is one of the primary production sites for poppy. It's one of the biggest drug producers per acre in the world right now. Incredible amounts of money, and the Taliban is very much in control of this province. They're in control of Uruzgan, Zabul, Paktia, Paktika, and Khost along the border. So the Taliban is pretty much effectively now in control of these provinces. They've moved into districts in southern Dikundi, are fairly in control of most of Ghazni and Logar, to the extent that they are now, they've now taken over several districts. The district leadership has had to escape, and they're well on their way to having almost complete control of those provinces. They're now moving north into Wardak province, which is a suburb of Kabul. And the extent to which they've moved into Wardak now includes them setting up night checkpoints. So during the night, basically they take over the night. They set up checkpoints in the roads and regulate as people are traveling through the province. And that's sort of the first thing they do as they start taking over a province. So in general terms, the Taliban is now about 50 miles from Kabul. That's where they were when I left 3 weeks ago. I got an email from a friend last week saying that on Friday, in the mosque in Kabul, the Taliban had come in and were demanding money from the men who were at Friday prayers. And the mullahs didn't feel like there was anything that they could really do to stop that. So, for whatever meaning you take out of that, the Taliban is really moving in. And so, if nothing sort of changes, if it just keeps going the way it is, we will lose Afghanistan by the spring. This is not the only area. This is the area that's being controlled by the Taliban. But in the rest of the country, you have a lot of violence, especially throughout the northern border provinces, between drug lords. The drug trade moves north into Central Asia on its way to Europe. There's incredible amounts of money to be made, and the drug lords are fighting each other. And so what you have is you have the Taliban destabilizing the southeast. You have narcotraficantes destabilizing the north and on to the west. And so you've just got a lot of instability happening, and it really is going to come to a severe state by the spring, unless something happens to turn it around.
Excuse me, quick question.
Yes.
Where in 2002, which was, I guess, the low point for the Taliban.
Yes.
Where were they?
They were pushed into Pakistan. They all went across the border.
So the point was, what's red and pink now was not red and pink then.
No. In 2000.
Or it was all that red and pink was below the border.
Yeah. All this red and pink was in here in Pakistan. Kandahar was maybe this pink, because they were still in this area, but the Taliban was all in here. And when you ask where is Osama bin Laden, he's in Waziristan or Quetta, one of those two places. He's in northwest Pakistan, where he's been.
What could happen to turn it around?
Well, what could happen to turn it around is we could really give it the attention it deserves in terms of military focus, resources. And we could get serious with Musharraf. There was an excellent documentary on Frontline 2 weeks ago, which is on the website if you're interested, talking about the Taliban in Pakistan and how they have, with Musharraf's blessing, have now taken control of the northwest frontier provinces. And we just continue to consider Musharraf our dear friend in the war on terror. We continue to give him wheelbarrows of foreign aid, especially military aid, and he uses it to prop up an administration that is increasingly fragile, that is increasingly under pressure from Islamists politically, from his own army, from the ISI security services, and from the Taliban forces in the northwest part of the country. So to the extent that we've given, we've let Musharraf off the hook, it has really come at a cost, and it will really require us to get serious with him to cut off their sanctuary in Pakistan.
Is he able to do that?
No, probably not.
Yeah, how about that?
No, probably not. And there you have it.
Yeah. When you said that the Taliban goes in the municipal area and asks for money, do they also try to sort of be robbers of all of the drug trafficking money, or is it their business?
It's their business. In the southeast, they are the drug lords. The Taliban gets direct revenue from the drug trade because they control the transit. They control the moving of the poppies.
Okay. Who are the big customers of all of drugs?
Europe. Uh-huh. Europe. Afghanistan is now supplying about 90% of Europe's heroin.
And where are all the U.S. forces in?
The U.S. forces have now been divided into kind of two groups. There's about 35,000 U.S. troops. 18,000 have now come under NATO control. And so they are now, for the first time since World War II, there are U.S. forces under foreign leadership. They're under General Richards, who's a British general. I've met him. He is incredible, absolutely incredible. We could not be in better hands than to have General Richards heading up the NATO forces in Afghanistan now. Those American troops are spread out throughout some of the most difficult areas, especially in Helmand and Uruzgan. Like I said, the Canadians have Kandahar. The Brits are down in the southeast with us. The Germans, God love them, are up there protecting Mazar up in Balkh province. Me and my dog could protect Mazar at this point. But the German government is absolutely opposed to the German troops coming down into the southeast area where they're actually needed. And that's the challenge with NATO, because every, you know, we have dozens of countries in the NATO forces, but every country has the authority to decide what their troops will or will not do. So you've got General Richards, who's got all these forces at his disposal, allegedly, but each country can tell him what they can and can't do. So when he could really use those hundreds of German troops to come down from Mazar and help down here, and then, you know, Mrs. Merkel goes before the German people and says they will not, that puts General Richards in a really difficult spot. The other half of the U.S. troops are on their own, primarily Delta Special Forces, and they are along the border, still engaged in the hunt for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. I don't know what it is they're doing looking for Osama bin Laden. Maybe they're like standing on the border of Pakistan with binoculars thinking he might like poke his head out the window. It's really quite ridiculous. Yes, of course you hear that we are in Pakistan doing whatever, but no one will admit that. And of course there aren't enough of us over there to be doing anything effective.
What about Karzai? Does he have any power?
Karzai has no power at this point. That's the short answer to that question. Let me move off the bad news. I'll be happy to take more questions later, but let me move off. I want to tell you what's happening at the beauty school. For those of you who've seen the documentary, you can get an update. For those of you who haven't, I hope this makes you want to see it. The Kabul Beauty Academy was started in 2003 by American women, and was supported by Vogue magazine and Clairol and the beauty industry. And it was a way to restart the beauty industry in Kabul, which is a bit of a misnomer because the beauty industry never died in Kabul. The beauty industry is intrinsic to the life of women in Afghanistan. And a couple of things you know you might think, well, my gosh, they're always covered up. Why bother? Well, precisely. It's a way that for women who live in effective isolation, and especially in the provincial and the rural areas, women live very much in isolation. Many of them don't ever leave their homes. They spend their days exclusively with the women in their families. And when women go to social occasions, which are always with other women, such as a wedding, they are dressed up to the nines. And you know, I just love the words, you know, that Van Morrison song, and the girls walked by dressed up for each other. And that's exactly what this is in this culture. The other piece of it is, if you had to walk around all day completely covered in a burqa, you would want to do something for yourself. During the Taliban, women were beaten if they were wearing fingernail polish or if they were wearing lipstick. Let me tell you, under every one of those burqas was lipstick, because it was just the smallest way to try and hold on and reclaim just a little bit of resistance to this. And so the beauty industry is really an intrinsic place. The beauty salons are an important social gathering place. As I said, for many women, they rarely leave the home, and women don't go to restaurants, they don't go to coffee shops, they don't go to parties, mixed gender parties in the evening. Women rarely leave the home in the evening. And so beauty parlors are one of the few places that women get to interact with women who aren't in their family. And so I like to describe it as women will go and spend all day at the beauty parlor, and they might even get their hair done. Because for us, you know, we go to a beauty parlor and, you know, it's really nice. You know, maybe we go for a treat. Maybe we're going to go get a manicure, or we go with a girlfriend and get a pedicure because it's her birthday. But by and large, for us, you know, going to the beauty parlor, it's sort of just another chore on a long list of stuff we got to get done. You know, pick up the cleaning, you know, go return the library books, and oh, go get my hair trimmed. You know, and you're in and out. The salon is a lifeline for women who have very little access to the community outside of their family. It's also a really important economic lifeline for the women who work there. Women have very few economic opportunities. They were completely cut out of the workforce under the Taliban, but now they've been welcomed back into the workforce. But it's still a very, you know, very gender segregated society. So the kind of opportunities you have for women are school teachers, tea servers in government offices, cleaning women, you know, just sort of very, very limited economic sphere. And for example, school teachers will make about $30 a month. A woman who has a beauty parlor with a good clientele in Kabul can easily make between $100 and $200 a month. This is real money, which the women have control over and are not in a position where their husbands necessarily know how much money they're making. So it really is a uniquely independent economic source of empowerment for them. So at the school, the women are trained to be hairdressers. They're trained in basic business techniques, how to run a business, how to price something more than it costs you. This is a concept we have to spend a lot of time teaching women. And customer service, really basic concepts about running your business and being a hairdresser. The top few graduates after every class will be invited to join the Oasis Salon, which is a beauty parlor that's part of the program, where they learn Western techniques, and at the salon is charged Western prices. So the international community are great supporters of the beauty school program by coming to the Oasis Salon and having hair, nails, pedicure, facial, massage, everything that you would get at a salon in the West at a level of quality that you would get in the West.
Were these salons available prior to the fall of the Taliban?
Before the Taliban, salons were central to Afghan culture. They were shut down during the Taliban because the Taliban said that they were fronts for prostitution. That's actually not accurate. The Chinese restaurants are the bordellos. But they were all closed down, which didn't mean that the hairdressers went out of business. They went into their homes, they went underground, and in the first photo there was a picture of a salon, and the hairdresser Malalai, she was one of the ones that had a booming salon during the Taliban because the Taliban would bring their wives to her. The irony was everywhere.
How do the women leave their homes to come? Are they comfortable going out in the streets?
In Kabul, this is Kabul, so women have a lot of mobility in Kabul. About 15% of the women still wear a burqa. In Kabul, it's called a chadari. We know it as a burqa. About 15% of the women wear the chadari. The rest are just wearing a simple headscarf. They move about. They get in taxis. In Kabul, women's mobility depends on the family. Out in the provinces and the rural areas, women are very, very confined to the homes.
Do you wear one of these when you're...
I don't cover my head anymore. I used to. I gave up on that. It just wasn't me. And, you know, and I'm just not going to fit in. I mean, let's just face it. You know, who am I fooling? So I just sort of go out there. If you saw the documentary, the woman on the left, Frebajan, who did my eyebrows before I left, is there. This is Sharifa. I looked for her in the movie. I didn't see her, but I may have missed her because she was in that class as well, and she did my fabulous hair color. And so they take good care of me. I worked as the logistics manager there last year, and I lived above the beauty parlor, which was an incredible experience. And so we spent a lot of time just trying to get the equipment that was needed, keeping the place running, and keeping everything moving. The beauty school is doing fabulous. They have another great class of women about to graduate, and things continue to cook along, and the beauty industry is really, really rebounding. There are salons everywhere in the city. This is a graduation. The woman in the middle in the orange is Debbie. If you've seen the documentary, she may come across a little harsh, but she is really, really keeps this school going. There's Debbie doing a bride. The brides wear green. It is the color of Islam.
What kind of hairdo I expected on you?
You know, it's funny. I put my hair up, and when I have my hair up, you know it's a no electricity day. Because we don't have electricity, either we don't have water, and I couldn't wash my hair, so we're putting it up. Or I didn't have electricity, so I couldn't blow dry my hair, so it was wet, so it had to get put up. So yeah, so the hair up is the no electricity hairdo. Let me just show you a little bit about what it's like to live in this crazy place. Winters are beautiful. They're miserable, but they're beautiful. We don't have snow plows. We don't have insulation. We don't have much heat, but
how
absolutely
cold is it inside?
It's cold. It's
always bundled up.
Really, yes. Afghans tend to wear their coats out of habit inside because their buildings don't have heat. And so it really, even when, it's sort of bizarre, even when like you're in an international office where the heat is cranked, the Afghans are all walking around in their coats. And you're like, but they're just not used to taking their coats off inside in the winter because nothing else is ever really heated.
Where do you sleep in the night?
I sleep in my bed.
Well, no, I meant like the people wear bundled up.
In the winter, well, they have like these really, really warm, these really, really warm blankets from China, and they're incredibly warm. And you think, why don't we have these in the States? And you realize it's probably because they like will burst into flames. but they're really, really warm.
Especially when they're burning.
This is my street. Where I lived last year when I lived above the beauty parlor. The beauty parlor is on the left. You can see some camels painted on the wall and a leopard print guard shack. That's how people found it because, of course, we didn't want a sign on it. You don't want any sign on anything indicating there might be internationals here. So you just tell people, look for the camels, you know, look for the leopard print guardhouse. And this is me in my car, actually. You can sort of see the streaks on my windshield as I'm waiting. You know, just traffic, afternoon traffic jam, waiting to get down and be able to park in front of the house. Cattle, those are cattle. You know, standard cattle, sheep, goats, camels, you know, just anything.
Those are pretty big ones.
Yeah, those are big animals. We've made huge progress in Kabul. We now have gas pumps. When I was first started going there, you got gas in your car, you pulled up along the sidewalk, and there was a guy with a 55-gallon drum. And he had a piece of plastic tubing, and you pulled out, and you stuck the plastic tubing in the barrel and got a suction going and stuck it in your gas tank. So we've come a long way. We now have pumps. But, of course, there's no electricity or anything to run these pumps. So what you get is you get a motorcycle engine or a lawnmower engine or some kind of engine of some sort, and you put it alongside the pump. And this one you crank up. And then get your gas. This is my bed above the beauty school. That is Tequila, my dog, as a little puppy. And you should know better than to leave your door open when you go to the shower. Living above the beauty parlor, because you come back and there's a dog and a sheep in your bed. And the sheep was Tequila's best friend. His name was Henry, but, well, inevitably, he was known as Kebab. If you didn't have kebabs for dinner, you might have fish for dinner. There is no refrigerated transport, so we tend to eat fish in the winter when it's nice and cold coming in from the rivers, because you don't, it's so cold you don't really have to worry too much about being refrigerated. And they'll nail it to a board, and the board is propped up outside the restaurant or the store, and you just stroll up and they'll rip off the fish you want and cook it right there for you. It's actually really, really delicious. But again, you want to eat it in the winter. You don't want fish, you can have some chicken.
You have a kitchen in your apartment?
In my house, yes.
You cook.
I have a kitchen in my house. Yes, I do have a kitchen in my house. It is the cleanest kitchen in Kabul. Every once in a while, I wander past it. Oh, there's a kitchen here. Rush hour. Rush hour.
You're just too busy scandalizing people.
Yeah, the foreign whore. We had elections last September, and the Constitution set out that one quarter of the seats in the National Assembly and one third of the seats at the provincial council level would be held by women. And so we had women running for office, and they were awesome. This is Sabrina, the Bollywood candidate. Her posters were everywhere, as you could imagine. Cab drivers paid for her posters, and they would plaster them all over their cabs. You'd see cabs going down the street, completely covered. I mean, side windows, rear windows, front windshields. They'd have like a little like eye thing, like this big to see through. They didn't drive any worse than they ever drive. And but she was, well, she didn't win. But she was really a phenomenon. Sabrina was just a joy to see throughout the city. Some other candidates, you know, this was really the most interesting campaign. There were tons of political advisors that came in. The National Democratic Institute came in. The International Republican Institute came in. All of these people who, you know, train politicians descended on Kabul for these parliamentary elections. And so you could imagine that some wannabe political strategist, you know, someone who styled themselves, you know, the next, you know, Karl Rove of Kabul, came up with this fabulous idea that this guy needed two different posters because he needed to appeal to two different audiences. You know, so on the left you've got, I am the modern technocrat. And on the right you've got, I'm the traditional Afghan guy. And it really made a lot of sense because, you know, if you want to appeal to a wide variety of Afghan voters, certainly there would be some who would be attracted to the image on the left and some attracted to the image on the right. But the sort of the strategic thinking sort of didn't make it to the part where they figured out where to hang each of the posters. And so all over the city, you had these two posters side by side. And so you're just, you know, you're sort of sitting there going, okay, it was a good idea to start with. But the other interesting things about these posters were the fact that the vast majority of the Afghan voters are illiterate. So they're going to go and look at a ballot, and, you know, how are they going to find either one of this guy's name? And so every candidate had a little symbol. And so you could simply remember that you wanted to vote for the wheelbarrow guy, either the wheelbarrow technocrat or the wheelbarrow turban guy. But you wanted to vote for the wheelbarrow guy. And so you go in on your ballot, you'd simply look for his wheelbarrow. And if you noticed on the previous poster for Sabrina, her little symbol were two rabbits. And there was a lot of urban legend, political rumoring, that the symbols were assigned by the Electoral Commission with their own little personal agenda, and that they were trying to really insult Sabrina by implying that, well, she, you know, like a rabbit. And so there were all of these, you know, sort of really scandalous political rumors going on about why people were assigned certain symbols. I don't think the electoral board is that clever, actually.
Did you do any advising?
No, I did not do any advising. I was still busy at the beauty school, but I did spend election day at the polling place in my neighborhood, at the women's, the men and women were separated for voting, and the women had their own voting section in my neighborhood at Zarguna High School, and I spent the entire day there with them. It was incredible. It was the most incredible. The first woman who came in, when I was sitting there in the morning, the first woman who came in, she flipped up her burqa and pushed that ballot in the box, and I just started crying. I mean, you know, what else can you do? That's my house. This is the middle of winter. It's about February, I guess. And we were doing a lot of work on the house. And these are the guys putting the sod in. They had brought the sod on a horse-drawn carriage and pulled it into the yard, and they were installing the sod. And that's tequila tormenting the horse. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful place to live. This is the nicest house I've ever lived in, let me tell you. There may or may not be a picture later on of when all my roses are in bloom, the yard is surrounded by roses, and just beautiful. Just a beautiful place. And I miss my tequila.
So you also live over the...
Well, I used to live over the beauty... All last year, when I worked at the beauty school, I lived over the beauty school. You know, you can only live for so long over a beauty parlor. It was fun, but really. So toward the end of last year, I moved into this house, me and Tequila, got our own dig, and I wasn't being paid by the beauty school. They didn't have any money to pay me, but I didn't have any rent and didn't really have any expenses, so I sort of lived off my credit cards. But toward the end of last year, you know, MBNA and Bank of America and Capital of One started suggesting to me that I might not want to live off my credit cards for yet another year. So I started looking for work, and I'll talk about how I pay the rent here in a minute.
Quick question on the, you mentioned the two separate balloting places, women and men.
Yes.
Would it be something that would be conceivable that the women's ballots might not be counted in the same way, or...
I think a good ratio would be three international monitors for every voter in that last election. I mean, the international monitors were sitting in each other's lap for this election. It was one of the most monitored elections there ever was. And so I'm very, very confident. In fact, I follow the women's...
Well, the international presence is there, that happens.
Yeah.
So you would wonder in a society like that, under other circumstances, what good it would do for the women to go voting.
Well, you know, it was interesting because the men really sort of got the idea that women had a vote. And so even in the very conservative areas down in Helmand and Oruzgan, you had voter education people going in and saying, look, all the women in your house, how many women you've got in your house, 12, 15 women, we need them to vote for whoever it is, whatever warlord was running for something in that area. And it was the classic Chicago machine vote delivery scenario, in that you had a bunch of guys sitting around and the warlord comes in and says, I want this seat in parliament and you guys better deliver the votes. Well, if you got 15 votes sitting in your house, you're gonna bundle them up and pack them off to the voting place. And that's what happened. Now, the women didn't necessarily have a choice of who they were gonna vote for. In the rural areas, women tended to be instructed who to vote for, but they voted. And in the whole scheme of things, it was something.
How would anyone know, aside from the voter, whom she voted for?
Oh, women in the society would not. I mean, especially in the rural areas. If the husband told the wife, you're going to go in and you're going to vote for this person, that's what would happen. I mean, there would be no... There's no way I would have the time to describe that psychology to you, but I would highly recommend a book called The Bookseller of Kabul. And at the end of the bookseller, and the book just describes incredibly what life is like for women. And at the very end of the book, the woman, one of the main characters, has a choice. For the only time in her whole life, she has a choice. She was unable to make the choice because never in her life had she been faced with a choice.
One quick question. Is Afghanistan the only country where it is designated or mandated that a certain percentage of women are in?
No, that's the European model. Many, many countries in Europe. And that's in the Constitution thanks to the European constitutional advisors. If it was up to the American constitutional advisors, God knows. The figure was one quarter in the National Assembly and one third in the provincial councils. And so now they have a higher percentage of women in office than we have in the United States. Let me tell you really quickly what's happening now. Now that I got a house and had to pay a rent and had to pay rent and had to actually, you know, kind of live this sort of real life, I was given the opportunity to develop a project plan for a USAID funded grant. And USAID said, go out and do something that increases women's political decision making. Oh, that's a, there's a real direct thing to do. Okay, figure this out. So I spent the spring traveling all over the country. And how you travel all over Afghanistan is you travel on military flights. There's very few commercial flights in Afghanistan. Most of the places you need to go, you're going to come and go from a military base. I got to spend 3 days on a Lithuanian military base. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. They were really, really happy to have me there for 3 days, and because they were really bored. And this is in Host with the U.S. military, and really got to see a lot of the country. And so I came up with this project plan where we trained women on the provincial councils. Now, the women in parliament, the minute they got to parliament, each of them had about three individual advisors. I mean, every organization throughout the world who had anything to do with politics descended on Kabul to train the women parliamentarians. You had to take a number to get near a woman parliamentarian. But the women out in the provinces who had been elected to these councils didn't have a clue. So I came up with this project where we were going to train these women on the provincial councils, and drew it up and thought it was a fabulous plan. Well, the problem was, is submitted this plan, and then come July, they came back and they asked me to do the project. And I always say that if I had thought ahead and thought they might have done that, I would have designed a much less ambitious project. I also have, when I came back in 2002, I started a nonprofit called A Little Help because I wanted to be involved. I mean, I wanted to work on projects. I wanted to really be involved with this reconstruction. And I started to talking to groups that were working over there, the UN, USAID, UNIFEM, all these people. And they were doing this great stuff, and they were talking about doing this great stuff. But they were big projects. It was moving really slowly. And they just weren't working with the women that I really wanted to work with. So I started my own nonprofit called A Little Help, started raising money, and started working on projects. And started going over doing, worked in the women's prison, worked in maternity hospitals, worked with teaching women business skills, all kinds of things. And even to this day, even though I'm busy, you know, doing work that's funded by big players, I still have A Little Help, and we're still really active. And one of the things we're doing is we're working with a clinic in Wardak province that is run by a member of parliament. Dr. Roshan Akwardak is a member of parliament. She's also an OBGYN. She spends her weekdays in Kabul running the country. And she comes back to her home in a village in Wardak on Fridays, our one day off. And in her yard is a yard full of women in burqas sitting there waiting to give birth. Literally waiting until she gets there to give birth. And a lot of time on Fridays, I'll go out there just to get out of the city, hang out with her. I hang out in her clinic, which is one room in her house, and we'll sit there and we'll be drinking tea and we'll be gossiping about everything that's happening in Parliament because, you know, as a former politician, this is all, you know, great, you know, we just have these great conversations. And we'll just be chatting, drinking our tea, and one of the women will come in out of the garden, decide it's her time, lay up on the table, have her baby. They'll cut the cord, they'll wash up the baby, wrap the baby up, she'll get up off the table, and 15 minutes later, she'll walk 4 hours back to her village. This is not Dr. Roshanak kicking her out of the clinic. This is just how things are. And when she's there on the table having that baby, she is not interrupting our conversation. They are absolutely silent when they give birth. You don't know that baby is born until you hear it hitting that bowl. It is the most, these are the most incredible, incredible women you can ever imagine. And so there I am, you know, Dr. Roshanak's my dear friend. And I say, look, I say, I have this nonprofit. I raise this money. We don't raise a lot of money, but just honestly, tell me what you want. Tell me what you would like. I'll go back to the States. I don't care what it is. I promise you, I'll find the money. Tell me, what do you want? You know, you want a sonogram machine? You want, I mean, this is like a room with a tile floor with a metal bowl. This is this woman's clinic. And she said, well, she said, you know what I could really use? I said, what, tell me? And she said, you know, she said, the women have such terrible nutrition. She said, they never get to eat any meat. They rarely get to eat any fresh vegetables. She said, these women live off basically rice and bread. She said, and what I really need are prenatal vitamins for these women so I can give them to them. And I went, prenatal vitamins? She said, yeah. So when I raise part of the money that I raised through a little help, we go out to the pharmacy bazaar. I've got a guy who gives me a good deal. And load up the trunk with prenatal cases of prenatal vitamins, drive them out to Wardak, and they're gone within the week. And so one of the things that I've really been trying to do is really trying to get her as many supplies as we can. After I got roped into actually doing this great project that I had designed, we had designed the program in April and come up with this plan where we were going to go out to the provinces, we're going to train the women, we're going to take the women out into their districts to meet their constituents, do all this fabulous stuff. Well, a lot changed between April and July. What changed between April and July is the pink mats that you saw a few minutes ago. We now had no trainers that were willing to go out into the provinces, and we had no provincial counselors who were willing to leave their capitals to go out to their villages. And so what we did is we brought them into Kabul and did the training. And now if you remember, my project was to train women provincial counselors. You know, let me just clue you in. They ain't Afghan women. What we've really, really discovered in the last 4.5 years of trying to do this work is that you can work with women all you want, and you could work with women until all of you collapse from exhaustion. But if you don't change men, there will be a limit to how far women will ever progress in this society. So what we decided to do, as long as we were bringing them into Kabul, we brought the entire provincial council of 3 provinces, both the men and the women. We worked with the women in the morning and the men in the afternoon, and then for several days we had them all together. And we trained them in different things. We trained the women in really fundamental empowerment, self-confidence. You've been elected the same as the men, you have a vote the same as the men, you have the same responsibility, and you have the same authority. Just trying to get them to envision themselves in this leadership role. We also taught them what, you know, we would consider some more basic political skills. We taught them public speaking. Now, we've got some politicians I know who could use some more work on that. But here, when we're training politicians in public speaking, we're teaching them to do kind of what I'm doing here, you know, stand up in front of a group and talk. Coherently is a plus, but talk. What we had to train these women was to simply be able to speak in a room with men. Mm-hmm. These are women who in their entire lives may have never spoken aloud in a room with a man in it. And so we had to literally get them to the point where if there were men in the audience, when they opened their mouth, sound came out. And that was the level of public speaking. With the men, we did something a little different. I mean, just look at this crowd. We taught them things like governance, accountability, anti-corruption. But we also worked a lot on what we term engendering. And it's a term that at its really fundamental levels, and at the levels we work on it in Afghanistan, is trying to take a group of these guys and convince them that women exist. That when they're making a political decision, when they're looking at issues such as security or education or healthcare, to also consider how those issues impact women and how their decisions will impact the women in their communities. Oh yeah, that's a real...
What was their response to this?
You know, it takes a while, but they get it. You know, because, I mean, okay, you can't tell. But these are genuinely compassionate men. These are men who really, in their hearts, really care about everyone in their communities. They feel that's their responsibility and honor. And honor requires them to take care of everyone in their community. And so when you talk to them at that level, you can sort of get at it. The other thing we had to do is, you know, everyone in the society who's been there throughout all this violence is traumatized, deeply, deeply traumatized. And some after effects of post-traumatic stress syndrome are attention deficit disorder, so you have to keep teaching them the same simple thing over and over and over. Anger issues, so you get people really violently disagreeing with something you're talking about. Just sort of wandering attention spans, all different kind of challenges, and just the sense that they have a lot of barriers to learning. And so what we did is we had to really get underneath that and around that, and so we used some really, really different teaching techniques. We did scream therapy, we did meditation, we did mild exercises, we did dancing, we did singing, we did painting, and we did sculpture. We gave them modeling clay. And in one exercise, we gave them modeling clay, and we said, come up with your vision for the future of Afghanistan. And we handed them modeling clay. It was unbelievable. One woman modeled the most beautiful bunch of grapes you would ever see. And she talked about how her vision was Afghanistan reclaiming its place as this agricultural fruit basket, as this agricultural place that could feed its people the way it used to. We had one guy who modeled a frighteningly accurate model of an assault weapon, and then put red clay X over the top of it, and he talked about disarmament. We had a guy who did this incredible clay model of a cell phone, like down to the little clay dots on the dial pad. And he talked about how he wanted to be increased communication throughout the country. And this is the kind of stuff that when you reach them in a different way, in a way that they're not prepared to block you at, you get just incredible stuff. They made me crazy for 10 days. The hair is growing back from the bald spot where I pulled it out.
Was it you? Who was with you at this?
Well, we had
a... Were they listening to you?
They never listened to me. They didn't listen to me for nothing because I was just the wacky, crazy foreign woman who was running all this. Oh, I forgot I put a slide. Yeah, there's the slide of the assault weapon and the grapes. They were just beautiful.
Yeah.
No, we had an Albanian woman who came and did the training. Because as a Muslim, she has a lot of credibility. She doesn't speak Dari, so we had a Dari translator working with her. They made a terrific team. And so I just came in when, people's butts had to be kicked. They spent a whole lot of time complaining about the food. They complained about they didn't have money to pay their taxis. Afghans complain about everything. Love them, love these people. They're, it's my home now. But complain about everything. And so, it was my job to come in and say, tough, eat it or starve, and, you know, and just, you know, just, it's just a crazy, crazy bunch.
Are you fluent in your language?
I am functional in Dari to the extent that I go into the market, I negotiate, I drive around, I get around, I can yell at people, I can fire people, but I don't have the conversational skill level that I would need to do a training course or to, you know, do a conversation like this. And, you know,
taking lessons?
Not anymore. It's not an excuse, but it's sort of a reality in that the women that I work with, you know, the women are on my staff that I spend all day with, you know, I could make them talk to me in Dari all day and help me with my Dari. But am I better serving by making them talk to me in English all day? Because an Afghan woman who speaks English writes her own ticket at this point. Every international organization in this country is dying to hire women who speak English. And so to the extent that perhaps working with me for several months can improve her English, you know, maybe I'm doing something there better than my improving my Dari. And, you know, I get by. I don't have a translator generally. I don't have one who follows me around.
You know, when reading the Kite Runner, it seems that Iranian, some dialects in Persian or Iranian are understood by speakers of Dari. Is that?
Dari is a dialect of Farsi.
Oh, okay.
So Dari, the two official languages of Afghanistan are Dari and Pashto. And Dari is a dialect of Farsi. They're written exactly the same. They're spoken quite differently. And so a Dari speaker will immediately know if someone's in Iran, from Iran, and vice versa.
Okay. And the script is the same?
The script, the written is, it's the Arabic alphabet.
Okay.
But in writing, the words are the same in Iranian and Farsi and Dari. But spoken, it's quite different.
Okay.
This is the crowd that we had at the end of the day. I think we accomplished a lot. I think we really helped, especially we helped the women and the men in on their respective councils go back and have a better ability to work together effectively. And if we accomplished nothing else, we certainly, I think, accomplished something there. Tequila has a boyfriend. had to put that in there. And, you know, all work and, you know, all work and no play doesn't happen in Afghanistan. We play as hard as we work. And picnics are huge. This was a picnic we had a few Fridays ago out on a river under the Silong Pass. They set up blankets for us by the river. They pulled fish, threw them on a fire, and we were just chowing as fast as they were cooking them. And yes, that is a bottle of wine. And yes, those are Afghans drinking the wine. And behind me in the creek was the bottle of Johnny Walker. Don't be misled.
But of course, those men look very different in that they're shaved. They don't have the headgear.
Yeah.
And the headgear differed depending, I guess, on the tribe?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The guy in the black shirt and the guy in the greenish shirt are returnees. They're my neighbors. They've lived in Dallas for the past 20 years. Coolest humans on the planet. The woman is actually a New Yorker, works for the UN. But the gentleman here sitting next to me and the gentleman with the fish in his hand are Afghans. They've been there the whole time. They don't speak much English, enough English to just have a really good time, but it is a very, you know, again, what's missing in this picture? Afghan women. There would never be an Afghan woman at an event like this because Afghan women do not socialize with Afghan men.
Will that change? The other thing I have is you said the voters are generally illiterate, so does that mean men and women?
Yes.
And the Taliban banned women from going to school, so there's a very high rate still of illiteracy, I would assume.
There's a very high rate of illiteracy across the board. Certainly it's a higher rate of illiteracy for women. But even under the Taliban, even the boys who were going to school, under the Taliban, the schools were simply madrasas. And pretty much all they did all day was learn the Quran by rote in Arabic. So there wasn't much that was advancing the education level of the men, the boys under the Taliban either. So you tend to have very high levels of illiteracy in both genders. Obviously, more women are illiterate, but you're not talking about an incredibly literate population of either gender.
So in the beauty school and your training,
We have literacy training for the women who need that. Yes, we had separate classes after the beauty classes, and the illiterate women could go to literacy classes. The women who are already literate would go to English classes. So we had additional training after the beauty training. And the women were separated. Yes, if you couldn't read, we had a literacy teacher for you. If you could read, we had you start working on your English.
Yeah, so you could order supplies, you could,
Oh, yeah, you have to know your numbers. Yeah, you have to be able to read the box. Yeah, you need to be able to read what color it is you're putting on someone's hair. But believe me, after some of the things you see, you're just seeing, how did that go?
The men didn't get angry, or they weren't
Well, the women who were in the beauty class were a self-selecting bunch. They were women whose families allowed them to be there in the first place. You know, families had to give the women permission to come to the beauty school. So you already had a family who was supporting some measure of independence of the women. And so this was obviously a self-selecting group.
Getting back to the election or the voting and the women who were afraid to talk, and how did they get elected if they didn't talk?
Well, you know, in many cases, they were the only woman on the ballot because these were mandatory women's seats. And so in a lot of cases, there wasn't a lot of competition for these women's seats. In Kabul, there was a lot of competition because you have a lot of educated women in Kabul who have come back from Pakistan or Iran or wherever, or were just hiding in their houses for 5 years. So in Kabul, you had quite a competitive field. But out in the more rural areas, generally there would be one woman running for each of those seats.
And she didn't really run, she just had the name.
Yes,
was there.
The name was there, and so she was elected. But we're trying to really get those women now to the point where they embrace this position that they're in. And many of the women you saw in that picture were in that position.
But one was assassinated.
She was not an elected official. The woman who was just assassinated, Safiya Amajan, was the director of women's affairs in Kandahar province. So she was at the provincial administrative level. She was an appointee of the governor of Kandahar.
So when a crime like that takes place, then what?
What?
Do they try to find the perpetrator? No.
Give me a break. This is Kandahar.
Do you feel safe?
I don't feel personally targeted. I feel that the violence in Kabul right now is daily suicide bombings and rocket attacks at night. I don't feel that they have my name on a list that they're looking for me personally. I feel that whatever danger I'm in comes from just the potential of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm gonna catch my breath. And I just want you to enjoy just looking at some of these faces. On my website are tons of pictures, book lists of other books you can read after you're done reading The Kite Runner, if you haven't read it yet, as well as other information about the projects that we're working on and how to contact us and anything else that you may find of interest. I would love for you to visit the website. And if you have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
I have a couple. Having just read The Kite Runner, I was intrigued with what, I guess for lack of a better term, you'd call the ethnic pecking order between the Pashtuns and the Hazara, and I think there's some others. But I noticed as you were flipping through those pictures that some of the people had rather more oriental features, and I suppose that's the Havala group.
Yes.
Could you say something more about that, how that works?
Yes, and how it doesn't work.
And how it doesn't
and
work.
How it doesn't work. Afghanistan is a very ethnically diverse place. You have the Pashtuns. We'll start off with the majority ethnic group are the Pashtuns. They're traditionally from the southeast part of the country, spilling over into Pakistan. And so you have an area of about the same size on both the Afghan and the Pakistan sides of the border, known as Pashtunistan. That border with Pakistan is not recognized by Afghanistan. And so Pashtuns will cross freely over that border. They don't recognize that border. The other one of the next primary ethnic groups are the Tajiks. And they, along the border, if you remember the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union, Tajikistan is one of those. The Tajiks were traditionally the ethnic group that had the government and the economic and the business and the educational power. They speak Dari. So Dari was traditionally the language of Kabul, the language of government, the language of business. And this was always a rivalry between Tajiks and Pashtuns. Ahmad Shah Massoud of the Northern Alliance was Tajik. And so he was a natural opponent of the Taliban and was one of the last commanders still fighting the Taliban when he was assassinated on September 9th, 2001. Moving down into ethnic groups, you have the Uzbeks, which again cross the border. Uzbeks in Afghanistan, Uzbeks in Uzbekistan. That's a very significant group. You have Turkmen, a wide variety of other ethnicities, and then you have the Hazaras. And the Hazaras speak Dari, but they have distinctive facial features. They have their they're felt to be descendants of Genghis Khan and the Mughal hordes, and so they have what are very, very distinctively Asian facial features. Because they're easy to sort of see, you know, from a visual standpoint, and I pick out who's a Hazara, they have traditionally been discriminated against in this culture. They have tended to be at the bottom of the economic ladder, at the bottom of the educational ladder. And even today, when you're in the city and you see people pulling carts piled 4 feet high with big screen TVs, it's a Hazara pulling the cart. Now, under this administration, the Hazaras have made great progress. The first woman governor, the governor of Bamiyan province, is a Hazara. Because Bamiyan is a predominantly Hazara area. So the Hazaras under this government have been making great progress because there has been a lot of focus on trying to advance the Hazaras in society. But still, they continue to be pretty struggling, a struggling group. And in The Kite Runner, he had to be Hazara. That character had to be Hazara. It's the only way it would have made sense.
Mm-hmm. You, in your earliest slide, you showed the
Well, yeah, you know, no answer about any question about Afghanistan. It doesn't start with, it's complicated. What's complex about the answer to that question is, number one, there wasn't violence under the Taliban. The Taliban were welcomed with open arms in the middle 90s. Because they were seen as the only force that could stop the violence of the factional fighting. Especially in Kabul, Ahmad Shah Massoud was on one hill, Hekmatyar was on the other hill. They were bombing the city of Kabul in between. And the city of Kabul was destroyed in the mid-90s by this factional fighting, by this civil war. And similar civil wars were being played out throughout the country between all of the Mujahideen warlords, who we had armed to the teeth during the Soviet invasion. When the Soviets pulled out, the Mujahideen were all left with all the more arms than they knew what to do with, and no one to fight against, and they turned on each other in classic Afghan fashion. It was the Taliban who came in from Pakistan, beginning in Kandahar and moving through the country, who brought peace. If you can call the lack of violence peace, they brought peace to the country and they were welcomed. They were welcomed with open arms. It wasn't until they really gained power and they're absolutely, you know, they were seen for what they were, and they really got more and more power and began to impose more and more of these strictures on the people. But even then, there wasn't fundamental opposition to the Taliban. Even today, you will hear people say, they'll make very casual comments like, well, during the Taliban, you didn't have to worry about locking your door. You know, it's like my grandmother, you know, always saying, oh, we never locked our doors. People make those kind of comments about the time of the Taliban. And so nobody wants, precious few people want the Taliban back, because they know it will just lead to a continuing cycle of violence. The vast, vast majority of the Afghan people just want peace. They're tired of war. They're tired of 25 years of war. And if there's any glimmer of hope in this, anywhere, the glimmer of hope is that the people of Afghanistan fundamentally want peace. They don't support the Taliban ideologically, because their version of Islam is not the moderate Islam of Afghanistan. Sufi Islam was born in Afghanistan, this mystical worship of Islam. Beautiful. You know, the Wahhabi Islam of the Taliban is not Afghan Islam. So people don't necessarily agree with them ideologically, but they're in a position right now where you're out in a province in the middle of nowhere, and the central government has done this for you in the last 4.5 years. And you're looking around going, what did Karzai do for me? What is he gonna do for me? And I've got these drug lords fighting themselves. I've got bandits throwing up roadblocks. We've got schools being burnt down. And you've got people going, where should we put our money? Who should we support? I mean, at some very fundamental level, you've got people saying, who should we support? And they don't know that Karzai's gonna survive. I mean, it's very Afghan to try and hedge your bets, because there's no guarantee in the minds of Afghans that the Karzai government is gonna survive. You know, if the only thing propping up the Karzai government is the US, they remember history better than we do. And they've seen us pull out and haul ass enough times, including after we pulled out when the Soviets pulled out and we ignored them. They know not to count on us. And if the only thing that's propping up Karzai is us, they're hedging their bets. They are hedging their bets. There's tons of Western women, both Afghan American women and American women, working with handicraft projects. I've got tons of friends who are doing this. What their struggle is working with the women to do, the handicrafts are beautiful, but where the struggle is the quality. Having them do it in a way that will meet the standards of the Western market. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of women working on handicraft programs in Afghanistan, trying to introduce the products to Western markets. There's a lot of women doing that. Awesome, awesome, beautiful stuff. But the challenge is training Afghan women where the attention to detail, the product has to be clean, the stitching has to be perfect, you know, the thread has to match. You know, these are things that Afghan women, you know, they do with what they got. And when now they're trying to make a product that will be acceptable for a Western market, it takes quite a lot of work. And that's the challenge that a lot of these projects are facing. But there's great stuff going on.
And I was just curious if jewelry is something that you noticed is particularly about somebody who cared enough about you to, you know, suggest
you. Yeah, it means different things in different areas as well as in different times. Mm-hmm. Now in Kabul, jewelry is just simply a sign of wealth. Mm-hmm. And at weddings, women are covered with jewelry from the groom's family who comes up, and you know, the line of the relatives, you know, lines up in front of the bride, and they put bracelets and necklaces and earrings and rings all over her as sort of, this is her gift, welcoming her into the family. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so jewelry has always had an integral part in this culture.
Mm-hmm. Is this what Sarah Chase is doing?
Sarah Chase is in Kandahar. God bless her heart. She's in the Bay Area doing her book tour right now, I guess. Okay. I just picked up her book. I'll be reading it this weekend. But she's down in Kandahar, and she's working on women's handicraft projects. She's worked on home building projects. I'm interested in reading her book and catching up, because I've just sort of, you know, always caught bits and pieces of what she's doing, because I don't go to Kandahar. How much, you shut me up.
Okay.
Fabulous.
Tell us what happened with the JAM project, because that was the last time I heard you speak.
The JAM project. I went over and designed a project where we were going to teach women how to make preserves, jams, jellies, pickles. Because this is actually a really traditional part of the cuisine. Jams, jellies, pickles. But in a society where you're at war for 25 years, where you've been refugees off your land, out of your homes, in refugee camps, you had an entire several generations of women who had lost that skill, whose mother couldn't teach them, grandmother didn't teach them, who kind of lost that skill. And so we took this opportunity to sort of try and reintroduce that skill to some women, but we wanted to take advantage of the fact that we were going to teach them in modern techniques rather than the traditional, not entirely healthy way to do things. And so we came up with this program where we taught them, you know, how to make jams and jellies and things, and we came up with these procedures. And, you know, the first step was wash your hands. And then we had to tell them why they needed to wash their hands. And then, you know, the next step was wash all your pots and pans and dishes and spoons and everything you're going to use. And then we had to tell them why they needed to do that. And so, again, we had to sort of tackle this in a really basic way and not, you know, make assumptions about knowledge that we would in the West. When I went there, I trained the trainers. We trained about 21 women, and out of those women, we chose 4 instructors. Those 4 instructors for the rest of the summer trained 624 women. And the program was not funded again by USAID. USAID decided not to fund the program again. But all those women who were trained, many of them are still doing the preserves. They went on to do a cooking project in the Afghan Center, where they continue to do some training on preserves. So it really just sort of has percolated out. And so while that specific program isn't going anymore, there's still a lot of people who are really interested. And now I hear all the time about some village or other, they're doing this project, and like somehow my recipes are, you know, they've got my recipe. And it's like, oh, that's my recipe, you know. And so you just never know sort of where this is going to just sort of bubble up.
Part of that, I understood, was to encourage the farmers to continue with fruit as opposed to poppies.
Hmm. Well, that didn't work. because, frankly, how much can you sell jam for compared to how much you can sell heroin for? No, the alternative livelihoods, there's this whole angle called alternative livelihoods, where you try and convince farmers to do this instead of poppies. And quite frankly, from an economic standpoint, there just ain't much that can compete with how much they can make growing poppies. One of the only ones we've seen is saffron, because saffron is actually priced per ounce higher than they could get. But I mean, how much saffron can you grow? So, in general, the alternative livelihoods projects are not working that well. They're just because they just don't make economic sense. They just don't make economic sense. Traditionally, the origins of the Taliban, Talib means student. So Taliban is plural. So Taliban literally means students. During the Soviet invasion, there was enormous both internal migration, internal displaced people, and external displaced people that flowed in both directions, east over into Pakistan and west over into Iran. During the Soviet invasion, you had the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters. You had all of the men, a lot of the men, fighting the Soviets, you had high levels of casualties, fatalities, and what you generated were a whole lot of orphans. Widows who were not in a position to feed their children. And so in these refugee camps, you had these orphan boys. And Saudi Arabia, primarily Saudi Arabia, came in to Pakistan, to where the near where the refugee camps were, and they established madrasas, religious schools. And they took these orphan boys and they put them in these religious schools where they housed them and fed them and took, you know, very good care of them. And the school, they taught them, again, how to memorize and recite the Quran in Arabic and how to be mercenaries. And what came out of those madrasas was an ideologically focused group of students who had had no exposure to women in their entire, for most of their lives, had no exposure to women, were trained in a sect of Islam, Wahhabi Islam, the Islam of Saudi Arabia, that was completely foreign to Afghanistan, traditional Islam in Afghanistan. And they were motivated to primarily bring peace to their homeland. Because, you know, that then toward the mid-90s, when you had the country fell into anarchy. It completely fell apart. You had all the warlords fighting each other. It was really a bloodbath. 500,000 Afghans in Kabul alone were killed. And so the Taliban were welcomed. And they came in as simply students of Islam. And that's how they presented themselves. And that's how they were welcomed, as bringing this moral force. Really a moral, they came in as a moral force. They were a military force not to be trifled with, given all of the financial backing of Saudi Arabia and other fundamentalist sources. But they presented themselves as a moral force. And they were welcomed. They were welcomed. They brought peace. If you consider that peace, they brought peace.
And they're still being funded by Saudi Arabia?
They're still being funded by Saudi Arabia, other fundamentalist factions, and now also by the drug trade. We are getting significant financing now from the drug trade.
It's ironic that such a moral group would be profiteering off
the
drug trade.
You know, and what you'll hear is that during the Taliban, poppy production was halted. The Taliban, you know, the Taliban stopped poppy production because they said it was against Islam. BS. What the Taliban did when they were in power is they eradicated poppy production from their military rivals. And they kept their production. And they financed their operations also by drug trade. So they are no stranger. They are no stranger to this. So please, the next time you hear some idiot reporter talking about, you know, the drug situation of Afghanistan, and they give you the background and say, during the Taliban, please talk back to the television on my behalf, because that is the biggest, that is the biggest crock. And journalists continue to just believe that when they're told it. It drives me crazy. Oh, someone sneaks up behind me.